Some music lovers believe Johann Sebastian Bach created some of the most sublime works in the whole classical repertory. As a composer, Bach changed and helped to define the whole language of Baroque music. He inspired many who came afterwards, and that includes urban visionary Jonathan Rose. In his latest book, The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life, he imagines the city as an ecological system in need of harmony. Jonathan Rose, welcome back to Living on Earth.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Jonathan, the title of your book takes its cue from Bach's famous composition, The Well-Tempered Clavier. Why did you pick this title?
Well, I picked it because I love Bach's music. And one of the amazing things that Bach did with his music was he tried to imagine the architecture of the universe and bring it to life on Earth for all of us. It's an amazing aspiration. And I believe we actually, with our cities, need to have very high aspirations. There was another issue, and that's the actual idea of temperament itself. About 2,500 years ago, Pythagoras, an amazing Greek mathematician, Pythagoras observed that the distance between the notes on a lyre were exactly the same proportion as the distance between the spaces of the planets. And he said this was the golden proportion, and everything should be tuned exactly that way. For the next 2,500 years, everything was tuned exactly that way, and it worked really well when you're playing an individual instrument in an individual key, but it turns out that you couldn't go from key to key to key. And for Bach to achieve his amazing goals, he actually needed an expanded range of music to deal with. By 1700, Bach was able to compose in what was called temperament, which is actually finding tuning to the spaces in between perfections. It's not exactly perfect, but it's good enough. And it really allowed for amazing music. It allowed him to unleash the entire range of the keyboard to express his music. And I feel that's something that we need. This vast integration is what we need to do with our cities also.
In your book, you make a number of analogies between city systems and works by biologists. How can we think of urban spaces as ecological systems?
There's an amazing biological idea called biocomplexity. And the core of the idea is that all of nature comes from a vast and integrated gene pool. So, for example, think about human beings. We breathe in oxygen and we breathe out carbon dioxide, and trees breathe out oxygen and breathe in carbon dioxide, and we all fit together. Where did all this come from? It comes from the fact that we have this common DNA. You've probably heard that. You know, human beings share 50% of the same DNA as a banana does, and 96% of the same DNA as a frog. These integrate us in an amazing tapestry of life. We do not have that same integration in our cities. But if you think of a city plan as the gene pool of a city, and we figure out how to tie all the parts together so that they actually can co-evolve together, what nature has that is so magnificent is an amazing adaptive capacity. And what human civilization needs, what our cities need, is that same adaptive capacity.
So you want to bring all these things together. And in your book, you write, imagine a city with Singapore's social housing, Finland's public education, Austin's smart grid, the biking culture of Copenhagen, the urban food production of Hanoi. And I could go on, because you go on to list another 20 or 30 cities. So I gather what you're saying is that right now, too many cities do things in silos, that they just focus on one aspect, whether it's housing or it's education or transportation, and this all needs to somehow come together.
So actually, I'm saying two different things. First of all, in that fantastic list that you read, the point is there are amazing things happening in cities all over the world. And even more interestingly, cities are consistently learning from each other, which is also really, really good. And so when I propose this idea of a magnificent and ecologically sensitive city, and people say it's impossible, then I can point and say, look, but if you just did what they're doing in Copenhagen, which is really great, and you're doing what they're doing in San Francisco, which is really great, and you're doing what you're doing in Seattle, which is really great, and you put it all together, you would have solved a lot of problems. Your second point is absolutely true about silos, that we function too much in silos. And what we're learning is, so for example, if you want to solve a key part of affordable housing. You need higher density to help pay for it. And if you have higher density and you put it next to mass transit, then that helps solve traffic problems and allows more space for parks and nature. And so the pieces all fit together. So we have to get out of our silo designing individual solutions and see we need to design integrated solutions.
So in your book, you outline some of the ways that cities can be thought of as having metabolisms. So talk to me about what constitutes the metabolism of a city and how it can contribute to social and environmental prosperity.
A metabolism is the flow of energy and material through a system. Actually, I also think information through a system. And interestingly, 98% of the things that enter a city leave it 6 months later as waste. And that doesn't work when you have a population of 10 billion people and a huge demand for resources. That's a very linear system. So think, for example, of in New York City, water is collected in reservoirs far north of the city. It comes through big pipes. It runs through our toilets and showers, etc. And it gets flushed out and it goes out into the ocean, ultimately, a one-way system. So we need to start creating circular systems, which again is just the way nature works. Nature recycles endlessly. So I looked at cities all around the world, and Windhoek, which is the capital of Namibia, a desert city in southern Africa, in the 80s discovered that it was growing rapidly and it was going to run out of water. Hired an engineer, and it built the world's first system that took its wastewater, cleaned it up, and turned it into its drinking water again, recycled it. The engineer who designed it said, we should judge water by its quality, not by its history. And that system's run for 40 years and never had a single accident. So in the cities, for example, in the American Southwest, which are running out of water, beginning to do something like this, now there's a water treatment plant in the Washington, D.C. area that is taking the nitrogen and phosphorus, which are very polluting elements, out of the water for $100 a ton. They're selling it to fertilizer manufacturers for $400 a ton. And so the waste treatment system is all of a sudden becoming a factory. They are capturing all of the methane that is coming out of the plant and using that to create energy. So all of a sudden, it's become a energy generator, not only providing enough energy for itself, but enough for the entire neighborhood around it. Now, imagine if we took these linear infrastructure systems and made them all circular systems. Imagine how many local jobs we could create, how much energy we could create, how many natural resources we could recycle.
So in your book, you discuss the decline of American cities in the 1970s. What was going on?
So a lot of factors were going on. First of all, jobs were moving out, first to the South. The great manufacturing union jobs that built so many middle-class lives were moving to the South and then abroad. The cities were incredibly polluted. There was not cohesive city planning. There was a lot of just disgruntlement and unrest, and the cities became more and more dangerous. And so people began to abandon them and move to the suburbs. And the more and more they moved to the suburbs, the more the cities, the very heart of them hollowed out, and they began to burn. So what's happening is that cities are back. They are cauldrons of opportunity. They're places where people really want to live. We have both young people who are coming to cities because they're bored in the suburbs, and cities are where the education is, where the innovation is, where the cafes and jazz clubs and music and all that stuff, the life is in the cities. They want to be there. And interestingly, the baby boomers are retiring, and they no longer want to move to gated golf course communities. They actually want to move back to cities too. For the same reasons the young ones are moving, but there's a second reason too. There's a lot of people retiring to live near their grandchildren. So there's a tremendous amount of revitalization in cities. And the issue is that's putting a great deal of demand on the housing stock. And there is not enough affordable housing for everybody who needs to live and work in cities. The answer is to create more affordable housing in cities. The only way to do that requires subsidy. And there are federal programs and there are state programs, but those are not enough. Another tool cities are using to address the issue of affordable housing, what's called inclusionary zoning. They're saying if you're going to build market rate zoning, a certain percentage of it has to be affordable. And that creates mixed income communities, which are really healthier for people.
You've, of course, done that sort of work yourself directly. We've talked in the past about your Villa Verde community in the South Bronx, a place that, you know, a few years ago, mentioning that, hey, get a place in the South Bronx, people would say, what? You're nuts. But I gather your facility is oversubscribed. What makes that place work?
So what makes that place work is, first of all, it's beautiful. It is extremely green. It has solar panels and great insulation and cross ventilation. And it's right near mass transit. It's right near a whole bunch of retail, so it's walkable to many things. And then the greenness actually continues through the entire public realm. So it has a children's playground on the entry level, and then it has an amphitheater where all kinds of community events take place. It has an orchard. We're going now, describing going up the roofs. It then has an orchard. It has community gardens. It has on the seventh floor, overlooking the whole city, a fantastic exercise room, community room. So it's really designed as an amazing place to live. And it is half affordable rental housing and half middle income co-ops ownership housing. So it's a really wonderful integrated community.
So talk to me now about the role that big data plays in making cities more efficient.
Let's start, first of all, with defining what our objectives are, because we're going to use big data then to make sure we're achieving our objectives. So one of the things that's emerging is the idea of communities developing their own community health indicators. This is a list of all the things that matter to them. It can be early childhood reading rates and high school graduation rates and reducing certain climate impacts and reducing water consumption and increasing affordable housing, increasing mass transit. Hundreds of items that can all be defined that reflect what a community's vision is of the truly sustainable and equitable place. Then with big data, we can measure to see where we actually are. How healthy are our families? How green are our communities, etc.? And we can track this through information coming from the public health sector, coming from our cell phones, coming from the internet, coming from devices all over the city. And we can see how well we're doing. We can then use the tools of city governance, which are the regulations such as building codes and zoning, investments that cities make in infrastructure, incentives such as tax breaks, all the things that cities use. We can see, are we getting closer or farther away from our goals? We can keep measuring, and we can keep creating a real feedback system that becomes co-evolutionary towards our objectives, just the way nature works.
So you talk about that living near green spaces promotes health and well-being. How are cities trying to increase that green infrastructure?
Cities actually have a lot of incentive to increase their green infrastructure. The city of Philadelphia, for example, was faced with a $10 billion mandate from the EPA to separate its water and its stormwater systems. And they went back to the EPA and said, how about if we spend $1 billion on parks and open space, on green, incentivizing green roofs, on planting more street trees, and we're going to absorb the stormwater before it actually goes into the sewer system. And it'll save us a huge amount of money. And the EPA said, yeah, that's a great solution. So here's what happens. When you plant trees, remember the climate is changing and it's going to get hotter. We now know that neighborhoods that have a lot of trees are 6 degrees cooler in the summer than neighborhoods that aren't. Trees absorb pollution. Trees absorb stormwater, saving cities costs and saving the outflow of polluted water into the oceans and rivers. And houses that are next to trees on streets with a lot of trees actually have higher real estate values, which is good for the homeowners, but also means they pay higher taxes, which is good for the city. And finally, we know that when neighborhoods have a lot of trees, actually the mental health of the residents is better than neighborhoods that don't have trees.
So, Jonathan, what's the connection between affordable housing and community strength?
Steve, that's a really important question. Over 20 million American families today spend more than 50% of their income on housing. And when you think about the additional amount of funds they have to spend on transportation, getting to and from work, and then childcare, it's impossible to think about how they can feed and clothe themselves, much less move forward with their lives. So having a base of safe, green, well-located, affordable housing is really critical for individual family advancement. And the goal of all this is to create what I call an equal landscape of opportunity for all, which I really believe is the American promise. So once you have safe, green, well-located, affordable housing, you need fantastic school systems in which every child in a neighborhood has an equal chance to get ahead. Going back to that list of cities you read in the beginning, Finland has the best school system in the world, the best school performance, and every child goes to an equally good school, whether they live in the wealthiest neighborhood, the poorest neighborhood, the most Finnish neighborhood, or the most immigrant-filled neighborhood. Every school is equal. We do not have that in the United States, and I believe that should be part of the American promise. Same thing with access to health care. The quality of health care should be equal to all. The quality of access to healthy food should be equal to all, which is one of the reasons why we're seeing this amazing community garden movement. We need access to parks and open space. We need access to multiple means of affordable transportation. We need access to arts and culture, access to great jobs. And the last thing, which I think is really important, is we need churches, synagogues, mosques, places of meditation, places of reflection. We live in a very frantic, overstressed life these days, and we need places of retreat where we can sit back as individuals and as communities and think about our own higher purposes.
Jonathan Rose's book is called The Well-Tempered City, What Modern Science, Ancient Civilizations, and Human Nature Teach Us About the Future of Urban Life. Thanks, Jonathan.
Steve, it's always great to be with you.